with Mr. Paul Miller here. And just want to start off that this will be made public. This information will be put into a public database. Are you comfortable with that?
I'm very comfortable about it. I'm glad to see this project going because a lot of these details are lost in history when the people die. When people die, the knowledge goes with them. So it's a very worthwhile project that you people are doing to make that a part of the permanent record.
Okay, all right. Well, when would you say, let's just start at the beginning. Were you born in Kansas? How did you come to Kansas?
Well, I was born in Kansas.
Where at in Kansas?
I was born actually in Kansas City. Our family, my mother and father, lived in Hamilton, Kansas, in Greenwood County at the time, but my mother had a complication of the birth, and so she wanted to go to a hospital instead of being delivered by a midwife or a local doctor. So they got on the train and went to Kansas City for the delivery. So I was actually born in Kansas City and only stayed there a few days till the family came back to Hamilton, and then later, before I knew anything about Hamilton, I was a year and a half old when the family moved to Eureka. So that's my basic knowledge.
And you lived in Eureka for quite some time?
Well, until I graduated from college, yes.
There you go.
Which was in 1940.
So then you were raised in Eureka. What was religious life like in Eureka? What was the religious background of your family, and how did they influence you during that time?
Well, we were Seventh-day Adventists, and of course has always been a minority religion, but it was extremely poorly attended in little town like Eureka. There were about four families, really, in the church. And it was a very simple building. It had kerosene lamps, for example. It had no utilities of any kind. It had a coal or wood stove, and no running water or anything. There's none of the amenities that we have today with the church. And it just had ordinary chairs, very simple chairs. And it was a very simple service, just led by lay people all the time. But they would occasionally have a revival. And this is my recollection of religion in Eureka, that every time an evangelist would come to town and have a revival, which was about once every year or two, why, a lot of the people would leave the church they'd been and go to the new one. And then another evangelist would come in and they'd leave that and go to his church. They'd have evangelists who were Baptists and who were Four Square Gospel and Seventh-day Adventists and Nazarene, any of the what we call the evangelical fundamentalists. They were the ones, of course, that really held the revival meetings.
So, and you were you brought to these revival meetings by your family?
Yes.
Did you attend any of them, you know, by your own will? Did you make
a
choice?
When I got to high school, I attended some, but I wasn't as serious as people were. I attended more because there was nothing else to do in town. And you go down there and just listen to the Salvation Army or whoever was making the message and have some kind of activity. It was strictly entertainment. I was never converted from one to the other.
Yeah.
However, when I was in high school, my father left home when I was 10 years old, and he was the one who was a strong Seventh-day Adventist. My mother only was because of him. So shortly after that time, by the time I was 12 perhaps, I left the Seventh-day Adventist and I joined the Congregational Church there just because I had some friends in that church. And then a few years later, I got active in the Methodist Church because they hired me as janitor. I was teaching the Sunday school class and ushering and singing in the choir, everything I could do besides cleaning up the church. So that's my basic religious history of Seventh-day Adventist, Congregational, and Methodist. But then after I graduated from college, got into my personal married life, I became a Congregationalist again because I liked the freedom of that type of religion.
So you said that your father was a Seventh-day Adventist, and he kind of had an influence on your mother. Do you know what the religious background of your mother was prior to the marriage?
She was Lutheran. Both of my parents came from Germany. And my mother was from Stuttgart. My father was from, he was born in the little town of Adorf, which is East Germany, which is not too terribly far from Dresden, and he came into Dresden quite a bit. So that was their background. They lived a very frugal life, as people would in the 19th century, of course. And his one family story that we have is that when he was an upper teenager, 18 or 19, he was in Dresden one night, I suppose, carousing on the streets, and he discovered that the cathedral was on fire, and he ran a mile or so to the fire station to turn in the fire alarm at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and they came down and put out the fire, but he was one that discovered and reported it. That's been a sort of a family story for a long time. But Dresden, of course, was the cultural capital of Europe for a long time until it was destroyed in World War II.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't mean to dwell on your father for so long, but since he was raised in Germany, and this is the late 19th century, he was born and raised there early?
Yes. He came to this country in about 1900, mm-hmm. or there, right, very close to 1900, yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you know?
And he was converted by a street evangelist from as a Seventh-day Adventist, because he'd grown up as a Lutheran too.
Yeah.
But he followed an evangelist there, and they wanted him to come to America, and they bought him a ticket in steerage on a steamer to come over here, and then he was on his own, and he just did any kind of odd jobs, whatever he could, but he was trying to promote the religion all the time.
So he actually came to America to as a devotee or a follower, a convert to Seventh-day
Adventist.
Oh, yes,
that's correct, as a convert of the Adventist.
That's what drew him here?
That's correct. And then he went on to school. He finally became a veterinarian. He had very good education. He was a very intelligent person. And he had a lot of education. He graduated from the University of Oklahoma, and then he had some other work at Northwestern Teachers College in Oklahoma, and he taught a while, and then he got his veterinary medicine training at Kansas State in Manhattan. It was then called Kansas Agriculture College. Mm-hmm. But then he was practicing veterinary medicine in the early days.
Well, to take us back in the progression, you said that when you got married, you were previously involved in Congregationalist work, then you became involved in Methodist religious work because of the janitorial work and things like that. But then once you got married, you became back in Congregationalist work because it was more suitable to your lifestyle?
Well, yes. I mean, of course, as a child, you don't really know much about religion. You hear what people tell you, and you follow what your parents do pretty much. But I had studied a little bit about the congregational movement, of course, in the early days of the country, and the fact that the polity of the congregational church is what I liked. Each church is independent locally. There is no higher authority than the church other than God. So, whereas the Methodists, of course, have bishops, the Presbyterians have presbyteries, and others have synods and so on, different kinds of hierarchy in their church. Of course, the biggest hierarchy is the Catholic Church, with a terrific hierarchy. And I didn't like the idea of a hierarchy. I liked the idea of local governance and personal interpretation. That is, I wanted to be able to study the Bible the way I liked to do, and to take it seriously but not literally.
Yeah. Okay, so, and I have it on good authority, although I can't reveal my sources, that you were heavily involved in the Congregationalist debates of the 50s about the split that was going on then, the big debate.
That is correct. There was an ecumenical movement in the 1950s to try to unite the various Protestant denominations into one great church, and of course there was previous movement like that in Canada, which is reasonably successful because there is a United Church of Canada, which is still in operation, and it pretty well has superseded most of the independent local denominations. And that was the attempt to do that in the U.S. But the leaders of the Congregational Church at that time and the leaders of the Evangelical and Reformed Church, which was a Dutch church, decided they would start this and get the two denominations together. And they voted in 1955 to combine them. Well, there are a bunch of Congregationalists that were independent, and they didn't feel that they wanted to join. So several groups broke off from there and formed the National Association of Congregational Christian Churches and the Conservative Congregational Christian Church. And then there was a Pilgrim Society for a short time but it didn't survive. However, the conservative movement and the National Association did survive. And I wasn't interested in the conservative side of it, so I did get interested in the National Association, and I went through quite a bit there and actually ended up being moderator in 1969 and 70. I was moderator of the National Association. And one of the outstanding things we did that year wasn't anything momentous, but it was memorable perhaps. Mm-hmm. We commissioned a medallion about 3 inches in diameter of the Pilgrim Landing, the 350th anniversary of the Pilgrim Landing. And we made 350 silver medallions, and I presented the first one to President Nixon, and the second one to Peter Black, who was chairman of the Greater London Council in County Hall, London, and to Henry van der Villigen, who was the burgomaster of Leiden, Holland, where the Pilgrims went after they were more or less expelled from England. And then Sergeant Shriver, who was the governor of Massachusetts, where they landed. And then I got number 5, the first one in civilian hands, which I'm rather proud of course. And then we sold the others around for churches and other dignitaries. I presented one to the governor of Kansas and maybe a few others. I don't recall exactly what, but that was one thing that I do remember from that movement. But we had a group of about 80 people that went back to London and to Leiden to trace these roots in 1970 at the 350th anniversary. It was a pretty big expedition for a small group, you see. Had half an airplane full.
Wow. Well, in the debates about the Congregationalist structure, How was that done? Was it primarily written? Would people exchange correspondence through mail? Or were there actually debates where they would organize a public forum or something?
Oh, we had lots of public forums all from 1955 to 1960. There were at least 5 years of intensive debates, public forums, presentations, and so on. I traveled the country, in fact, making those. I went to the East Coast and the West Coast and a lot of points in between to try to promote our way. We have probably fewer than 400 churches in the National Association, maybe 375 or something. I don't know the exact count now, but I know it's been right just under 400. And then we have about 200 or maybe 250 in the conservative congregational side. And then there were about 5,000 went into the United Church of Christ with the merger with the Evangelical and Reformed. However, a bunch of those have dwindled and gone. I think there are only maybe 3,500 or so now congregational churches went in there. It really, the merger did as much damage as it did help, I think. They lost an awful lot of churches to these two other movements that they didn't like. Yeah. And also to some that just plain disbanded, became community churches or whatever. It was a very divisive situation instead of a uniting situation.
Mm-hmm. So, when in your travels, were there any people that you came across that stood out as notable, or just stood out as kind of crazy character, or who? What were some of your opponents like that you engaged in debates? Was there someone that you regularly debated that was?
Yeah, well, you know, the debates were never violently personal, and I debated with a lot of people, and I probably lost a lot more than I won. I won two or three, or maybe four. I don't know where churches were on the line. They did, but in more cases than not, they went with whatever the preacher would say, and the preachers were pretty well convinced they had to do this because they were going to lose their annuities if they didn't. You see, they had a pretty good club over the preachers. The United Church took over all of the funds that had been in the Congregational Council before, the missionary funds, the building funds, the retirements for the ministers, all these things. So it became pretty big pressure. I know of several ministers that I talked with said, well, they would certainly like to stay independent and go with one of these, but they were at the point where they couldn't afford to lose what they had invested.
Yeah.
So it became a financial thing for many ministers.
Would you say that that was the primary reason?
No, that wasn't the primary reason, but it was a reason.
Pretty big reason?
Yes, it was pretty much for the ones that I'd talked with. Of course, I mostly talked with the people in the Midwest. I did travel, as I say, to the East Coast and West Coast, but most of my contacts were here in the states of Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. That's where I did most of it.
Well,
and that's where most of the preachers that I ran into that said they were concerned with their livelihood in retirement. If they were close to retirement, you could see why they'd feel that way.
Yeah. What would you say then was the primary reason for them being taken into the fold of a larger hierarchical structure for most?
Well, the reason, of course, was they were trying to unite Protestantism, which has been split into 300 or so denominations. It's hard to know because there are many French denominations that you don't really understand all of it. But that was their whole point, was they thought they would get mainline Christians into one unified church. But they never got any more except those two. Nobody else ever joined them. Following that, there was a consultation on church union where they got the Methodists and I forget the Presbyterians and a few others. They did a lot of talk. But when you go to unite, you find everybody says, yeah, we'll be glad to unite with you if you'll do it our way. The Methodists, for example, would be real glad to have everybody unite if they could keep their bishops. And, of course, the Presbyterian-type organization and the Congregational-type organization, those two polities, didn't want bishops.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't go along with that. It's interesting to note almost anything when you try to get a compromise. Anyone's willing to compromise if you'll do it my way. I'm an engineer by profession, and I remember one time early on, we were trying to establish a mean aerodynamic cord on a wing, which is a fairly important doctrine. If a wing tapers, you have the cord of the wing is changing all the time, you see. And for practical purposes, you need to know what is the good mean on that. Well, you can either take a trapezoid and figure what the distribution would be there. You can adjust the slope of the lift curve, or you can come in with a stress factor in the thing. The aerodynamics people wanted to have a mean aerodynamic cord defined with their slope of the lift curve in there. The stress people wanted to have it defined with the stress factor coming in. And the weight people wanted to come in with the mean geometric cord, which was just based on a trapezoid. And I had the crazy idea one time that we ought to finally agree. The numbers were not much different. They were only maybe a half an inch or an inch different. But I said, we ought to have one mean aerodynamic cord for this airplane. We shouldn't have three. Oh, boy, everybody was in favor, but you've got to do it my way.
Yeah.
We never did get that thing solved. Right now in Wichita, we're trying to get unified trash service. Some neighborhoods have been able to get one trash hauler to come into the neighborhood instead of four or five. It saves wear on the streets. It saves cost. It's simpler for all concerned. And I did the same thing in our neighborhood. At one of our neighborhood meetings, I had gone and had some of the trash companies, made some proposals, and we could save as much as 40% on our trash bill if the vast majority, like 75 or 80% of our neighborhood, would take one carrier. And I tried to convince the people, and oh, everybody was all in favor. They wanted to save 40% of their trash bill, which would be real easy to do, but you've got to do it mine. I like my trash hauler. I don't want to change. And I spent months on that trying to get our neighbors together, and I finally gave up because nobody would do it. And that's really the problem with a compromise, and that's exactly the type of compromise that we ran into in this consultation on church union. Nobody wanted to give up his particular thing. So that's why we have all the denominations today, because everybody's got a particular small item. He doesn't want to look at the big picture. He wants to look at the particular thing that he wants, and he has to be that way or he can't believe in it.
Well, looking back, I'm sorry, we kind of skipped over a bit of history there. You were born in what year? I'm sorry, I completely skipped my mind again.
I was born in 1918.
1918.
During the last part of World War I, January 1918. I'll be 92 in about 3 weeks.
Wow. Well, if I don't see you before then, happy birthday, of course.
Thank you.
But
well, I tell you, last year I got a birthday greeting from Robert M. Gates.
Really?
He was one of my Boy Scouts.
Huh.
I was a scout leader for 20 years here in Wichita, and I've had a lot of scouts that have gone on to greater things, and he's probably the best known one of all. And I was floored, I was amazed when I got a birthday greeting from him last year.
That's something. Yeah.
And I sent him one on his birthday in September this year.
Nice. Well, so then you were in your early teens then You were in your early teens when the Depression set in during America?
I remember the Depression very well. Well, I certainly do.
And you were in Eureka at that time, correct?
That's correct, yes.
What was the church or any religious organization like during that time?
Well, it was terrible. I mean, they would pass a collection plate 2 and 3 and 4 times on a Sunday, really, literally, because they didn't have enough money to keep the lights on.
Hmm.
It was terrible. The Depression hit the Dust Bowl area out here in Kansas even worse than it did in some of the industrial areas, but it was tough all over, with 20% unemployment nationally and probably 30 and 35% in some of these smaller communities. There just wasn't any money available. People hung on to every penny.
Mm-hmm.
And religion was really underfinanced. It was hard to keep a preacher because nobody could raise the salary for the preacher. You could hardly even pay the utility bills. There were a lot of churches folded during that particular time because they just couldn't afford to keep on going.
And your father, you said he left early on. I'm sorry. When did he leave?
He left in late 1928, early 1929, I think 1928, right. I was 10 years old, right up almost 11 when he left.
And how did that affect your mother's religious ideas?
Well, it was pretty serious. We had no income. And my sister had an older sister. She went up to work right after high school and worked for $4 a week. And we were tickled to death to get that. I had a job in a jewelry store that I started at age 11. No, age 12. I was 12 when I started that. And this man felt sorry for me and took me in to sweep the floor and to help repair clocks and watches and so on, which I did for several years. He hired me at 15 cents an hour, and then he told me about 3 months later that he couldn't afford it. He was about on his back, too, you see, at that time. He was taking stones out of rings and melting down the gold and selling the gold. That's how hard up he was. That's a fact. And he couldn't keep me. And I begged him to keep me at anything, and I was going to work for a nickel an hour, but he finally said he'd give me 10 cents. And he could afford that, but he couldn't afford 15, so I stayed on and worked for 10 cents an hour for years. And I got this job as janitor of the Methodist Church. That was just outstanding. That was $15 a month. I could just hardly believe there was that kind of money available to anybody. We could start eating again, but we had garden. We did a lot of fishing and different things to try to raise chickens, try to keep going, but a person today just can't understand what we went through. And then I decided I was going to go to college, and I was going to go no matter what. My sister, who was older, decided she wanted to go, even though she was older, but she was also quite intelligent. And we decided to go, but we didn't know what we were going to do with my mother if we weren't able to support her with my $15 a month and my sister's $4 a week, so which is about $16 a month. So we applied for welfare, and they weren't going to give my mother any welfare. They said, no. You're both out of high school now. You've got to take care of your mother. We can't take care of her. And we said, well, we're going to go to college anyway. We got on the NYA, National Youth Administration, one of Roosevelt's depression programs. Each could make $15 a month, which was just barely enough to pay $5 room and very little for food. We didn't even have books a lot of times. I had to borrow books. But we decided we're going to go to college. She went 1 year and got a certificate to teach in a country school. She was $50 a month for 8 months of the year, but that was big money for her. And then I went ahead and finished my school for 4 years. And my mother was on welfare for that year. And I've been sending Greenwood County $500 a year to pay back for that $100 a year that they paid her that for some years now. Because with the inflation and so on, I probably still haven't paid them back what it was worth, but at least it salves my conscience to know that I'm trying to pay that back. But without college, I wouldn't be here today. I know I certainly would have never been in a professional job. But it was depression was terrible. You just can't realize what it was like. No matter what anybody says, you've got to live through it to know what it was.
How did that affect? How did the depression and the economic situation affect the preaching style? Or I mean, what comes to mind particularly for me is the Seventh-day Adventist churches in Eureka.
Yeah.
Were people like that? Were there millenarianistic ideas of the impending rapture, things like that? Was that changed? Were there teachings changed, or was the message?
No, the message is essentially the same. It's a Bible-centered message. They believe the Bible literally, Old Testament and New Testament. And they had dietary restrictions, of course. They're rather strict. And their not working on the Sabbath was very important to them. And it was, but the message really didn't change. But it was sure it was a struggle financially. My father did some of the preaching, and a man named Clifford Welch did some of the preaching, and a woman named Mrs. White did some of it. And there were no paid staff at all, and they even had trouble to just keep the doors open, just to buy stamps for postage and make repairs on the building, because they had nothing else. But they could just. The people they had, the families they had, were very poor anyway, and if they could bring 5 or 10 cents a week into the collection, that was about all they could have. I don't imagine they ever got over a dollar a week coming into that church. It was just a labor of love. I don't know how they got their original building, but I know that they kept it. They tried to keep it up.
How did World War II affect the religious climate and the religious communities in Eureka or wherever you were settled during that time?
Well, of course, in World War II, I was over here in Wichita. I wasn't really in Eureka anymore. I was working here in the aircraft industry as an engineer. And so far as I know, the communities went pretty well because there was money there. The farming community, the farm prices were up. Food was in great demand, of course, and I'm sure that the economics turned out to be a lot better than they ever had been during the Depression years. That turned around the farm belt completely. People who'd lost their farms were bitter then, of course, that they had to start all over. But the farming did work out reasonably well.
And how did that affect the religious communities? Were there certain peace churches or churches that were very passionate about the war effort in this area? Do you remember?
churches pretty well supported World War II. There was very little pacifism because the country had been attacked. I don't know of any church that really. Well, the Mennonite Church has always been a peace church. We didn't have that in Eureka, but there were a few like that. But most of the churches did go ahead and support the war movement. There, I think, was a little. That's where there began to be a little return to fundamentalism. There, in my early recollection, was that I was really anyone who was Seventh-day Adventist or Nazarene or something was looked down on in the community. The mainstream religions very definitely looked down on these fringe religions. But they have risen after World War II with the fundamentalism. Fundamental religions are the only place where there's been any growth. The mainline religions have gone down, and in some cases gone extinct, really. But the ones who preach the fundamental message seem to be able to thrive.
So after the mid-50s and into the early 60s, after the Congregationalist debate, did your church, the church that you belonged to, join up with a larger group, or did it stay independent?
No, we stayed in the smaller group, yeah. Yeah, we had a vote, and we voted 2-1 in favor of not joining the United Church of Christ. There was another congregational church in Wichita that did vote to join the United Church of Christ, but only by a very small majority, like 55-45%. But we had 67% vote. Ours was really the stalwart church there. And again, I had a few people, cohorts there, that were as interested as I was in trying to keep it.
Hello.
Are we interrupting you?
No, I'm not going to be in here for another hour. I'm just setting up, so just feel free and have a piece of candy.
Okay. Thank you very much. Lost my train of thought there. What was the name of the Congregationalist church that you belonged to at that time?
In Eureka?
Or in Wichita?
Wichita. Was Plymouth Congregational, and it's still that.
And that was the one during the 50s and the early 60s that you were debating within?
That's right.
Which Congregationalist church was it that you were a member of?
I was a member of Plymouth. I joined Plymouth Church back in the 1940s, early 40s, when we came to town. And this was in the 50s when we had this division
and you
that
were still...
came in. But I've been there. I'm still a member of Plymouth Congregational Church there, have been all along. But yes, it voted in the late 1950s, whenever it was. I can't remember the time. But we voted to stay out of the United Church of Christ and then later voted to join the National Association of Congregational Christian Churches. But I got affiliated, I guess affiliated would be the word, with the National Association in 1958. And I was active in that until... probably about 1990, and of course I've slowed down in the last few years. I used to attend all of their meetings, and I was also active in the International Congregational Fellowship, which has connections in, I think, about 20 different countries, something like that. I've met in England, I've met in Holland, I've met in Korea, I've met in Australia.
Wow.
I've gone to all of those meetings. I was the North American secretary of that for a long time, and then I was the financial officer of it for several years, but I finally resigned. Travel became very difficult in older years, and so I just have pretty much dropped out of that. I still keep my contacts, but I'm not doing any active work in that today.
But are you are still an active member of Plymouth Congregationalist?
Oh, yes.
Do you attend regularly? And
well, I don't attend regularly. No. That's a long story. I take care of an elderly woman. I've done quite a bit of work with the elderly people there, and several of them have named me executors of their estates, and I've probably been a half a dozen that. And this last one was a woman some years ago when her husband died. It's been 17 or 18 years ago. Her husband died, and she thought she was dying, and she wanted me to take care of her affairs and take over, and she's still going on, and I've been going there 6 days a week for I don't know how long. And I finally just quit going to church. I had a little time for myself, and I told some of the members if they'd start taking care of Gwen, that I would come back to church. And I haven't been for probably 2 or 3 months. I go probably every 3 months, something like that. I don't go regularly at all. I'm sort of ashamed of it, but I have to have a little time for myself. And unfortunately, the people of that church are more interested in other things. I had a little run-in with one of the ministers about 5 or 6 years ago. I asked him to do some things for Gwen. And he said, Paul, now, Plymouth Church is not a social service organization. And I said, Bob, I said, you're absolutely half right. I said, it's a social organization, but it's not a service organization. And that's when I started, when I slowed down on my church attendance. So he knows exactly why and what went on, why it was. But I do go occasionally. I'll be going probably next Sunday and probably the next one for Christmas, but not.
So how would you describe how your religious perspective has changed over the years since the mid-50s all the way up into the present day?
Well, of course, I've become more of a humanist, I think, over this time than anything else. I feel I've heard practically all the sermons. I don't hear anything new anymore because I've heard people expound on their common topics. One time a preacher was going on about John 3:16. He thought that was the only thing there was to do. That was the most important thing there was to believe. And I said, I'd like to see you look at 1 John 3:17, which talks about service and giving. And I said, I think that's more important than the other. I'm much more impressed with Christian service than I am with Christian belief. And yet there are an awful lot of people that say belief is the only thing that's important, that you've got to believe. And I say you've got to serve.
I know your wife couldn't be here, she's busy, but how would you say that your wife's religious perspective or her perspective on life has influenced you or your religious
perspective? It's probably influenced. She's a lot less religious than I am, truth is known. She was a member of Plymouth for many, many years, but she has pretty much dropped out. She attends church maybe once a year. That's all. One time several years ago when I filled the pulpit at Plymouth, they were shorthanded. I've done that a couple times. And anyway, she wasn't even going to go. And I told her I felt sort of insulted that she wouldn't even go to hear me speak. And I went ahead and drove down there, and then I later discovered she was in the back pew, but she planned not even to go there. So she doesn't go very often. She'll go once a year for a special occasion. But that, I'm sure that has influenced me a lot, too.
And, of course, I know that you have a son. That was my authority on your congregational debates. I have revealed my sources. No. But do you have any other children?
Oh, yeah, we have 4 children. Our second son lives in Bangalore, India.
Wow.
And he was at one time after he was in, when he was in college, later years in college, he decided he wanted to join the Episcopal Church because he liked the ceremony and the rituals and so on of that. And so he was an Episcopalian for about, I'd say maybe 3 or 4 years, but then he dropped that and he's not in any church anymore. And of course, it'd be hard to find a church in Bangalore that you could attend. But then we have a daughter who lives in Eugene, Oregon. She's a Unitarian. She's gotten real interested. Of course, the Unitarian Church split off the Congregational Church. That was it wanted to be more liberal than the Congregationalists were, so they split off, and they certainly don't want anything to do with Trinitarians. And then we have a youngest son, Jeff, who's in Colorado, and he never has had very much religious experience. So it's been tapering off. You see, with Tim, Tim was ordained in Plymouth Church in Wichita after he went to seminary. Well, that's where he was ordained. And then he served a couple of churches, and then he decided he didn't want the ministry. He wanted teaching instead, so that's when he went back to get his Ph.D., but he's the one that has kept a closer connection with religion, and the other one's tapering off to no religion. But every one of our family is service-oriented. that we do believe in helping mankind, which I guess we'd consider a humanist thing rather than a religious thing. A lot of people would criticize us for being humanists, but that's what we believe in. I think that's what the New Testament preaches all the way, is love for your fellow man, and that means helping them whenever you can, in any way that you can.
How would you say that your religious perspective has influenced the viewpoints or the worldviews of your children? Did you attempt to actively bring them to church and teach them certain things?
Oh, yes, we took them to church, but of course the Plymouth Congregational Church is one of the more liberal congregational churches, it always has been, and we don't have creeds in Congregationalism, we have covenants, we promise things, but we don't have belief statements. That's what a creed is, of course, is a belief statement. And they were active in their Sunday school and in their youth groups and in other things in the church. And, of course, as I say, Plymouth Tim has preached in a number of churches. And pardon my saying so, I think he's a pretty good preacher. Mm. He doesn't dwell on the Bible messages. He'll bring them in, but that's not the theme of his. The theme is a message that he wants to give, and people will listen to it. And I listen to it, and that's what I like. But I've heard so many messages off Bible subjects that I feel I've heard most of it, and I don't see any reason to go back and hear that same thing over and over again.
Returning to the past, I hate to go back and forth and back and forth, but you said that your father, Seventh-day Adventist, left the family about late 1920s?
28, 29, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. The Depression was just coming on at that time, you see. He wasn't able to make a living, and he and my mother had serious difficulties, and they just decided to split. But he couldn't furnish any support. Ellis is sort of a funny story, but he just went around from one place to the other. He went to Missouri, and then he went to Western Kansas. We lost track of him for a long time, and I finally ran him down one time and reestablished contact. But my mother wouldn't have anything to do with him after that. In fact, I got him to come to Wichita. He used to bring him to Wichita for winters because he would just live in a shack someplace, and I was afraid he's going to freeze to death, and we'd bring him down here for the coldest part of the winter. Mm. And one time I took him down to see my mother, and it was a very awkward situation.
I can imagine. Was he still a Seventh-day Adventist?
Yes.
Even in the later years?
Yes, he was still a Seventh-day Adventist up until he died.
I'm sorry, it seemed like you were going to say something there, did you?
You what?
It seemed like you were going to say something. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I probably said too much.
Oh, no, no.
About my family things, usually don't expound on that, but I don't mind or nothing I said that I would object to being made public, but it's just something most people wouldn't be very interested in, I don't think.
No, it really helps us to understand the history of it. So
I really am proud of the work that I've done with the Boy Scouts and with... I worked for a long time with hiring the handicapped, trying to get them into mainstream employment. And I traveled nationally on that a great deal from East Coast to West Coast trying to get that. So I've had a number of service to mankind that I've been proud of, much more really than my church work, more on the action side than the belief side.
Well, I don't think I have that many more questions. I think I've hit the main points. Do you have any other interesting stories, anecdotes, personal opinions, anything? I mean, if you don't, it's okay, but is there anything else you'd like to share about your personal family history, your religious history, any funny stories?
This has nothing to do with religious history, but I'll tell you one mention about my father's being an Adventist until his death. Mm-hmm. He died under very strange circumstances. Hmm. He was building a house, and he never really got it finished, but he had the thing framed in, and he was living there, but he had no utilities or anything like that. And so he was having a kerosene lamp, and his house caught fire, and he burned to death. And the we went up there. It was in Junction City, and we went up there to my sister and I did to. In the middle of the night, we got the call that his house was on fire, and then when I tried to claim the body to make a burial, why, they told me I couldn't have it. The police had put a hold on it. And I finally talked with the chief of police to find out what was going on, and he said, well, he started quizzing me, and of course, you know, they really get up above you at a high level and come down. You think your police are your friends until they get into something like this. And he said, there was a transient was reported to be at your father's house last evening, and we know that sometimes he put up people, let people stay overnight with him for something like that, bums, railroad bums and stuff. And what do you know about that? Well, we talked quite a little about it. It kept leading questions and leading questions. And finally, they got around to say, well, your father, he didn't dress very well and so on. And said, did he have any gold in his teeth? And I said, well, not that I know of. I said, he was not one for ostentation. And I just, and also was one, had no money to speak of. So I just wouldn't think he would. And then he came down and he said, well, this body we found there had gold in its teeth, and we think that that was the transient that he'd put up, and that he left town and set the house on fire to burn that man. I said, what in the world are you dreaming? And I said, you know he doesn't have a car. Yes, we know that. You've probably checked the bus schedules. Yes, we've checked that. He didn't get on the bus. There's no train stops here in town. How do you think an old man would get out of town? Well, we don't have any idea. He may have had an accomplice in this or something. But we think he's left town, and this is that. And what we propose to do is to bury this body over here as an unnamed person. And if in 3 years your father hasn't turned up, well, you can reclaim the body and we'll exhume it and put it over there.
Wow.
Now, I want you to sign this paper, get it all drawn up, that we can do that. You permit us to do that. And I says, now, why do you want me to sign that? Well, you're the next of kin, and so you're the one who would have to give permission to do that. You're now the owner of the property and where the body was found. And I said, now, wait a minute. I said, if I'm owner of the property, the next of kin, that means my father's dead. If my father's alive, I've got no claim to the property. I've got no responsibility for the property. Why do you ask me to sign that? I said, this is ridiculous. Well, he'd never had anybody argue with him like that, you know. Well, we got to see about this. So about 15 minutes later, he came back and he said, okay, we're going to release the body to you to bury. Now, this is what small-town police can do.
Yeah.
But that's always been sort of a funny story, but it's sort of gruesome, but that's exactly what you run into in a situation like that. They had it all set up that he committed murder or something, you know, and then it skipped town. It was absolutely...
Yeah.
But it was all based on the gold in the teeth. I didn't think he had gold in the teeth, but of course I didn't know because I never followed his dental records.
Yeah.
But that was a body had a gold tooth, apparently.
Interesting. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, well, I don't know whether... Well, I don't know. There's a lot of little funny stories, but there, I don't think there's anything that really would bear very much thing on this. I think religion is very important to people, but I don't believe that any one person, any one denomination, has the answer to all of this, all of the religions, and that's why we have so many differences. And people get so carried away with their own form of religion, they're willing to murder people for that. And this comes in on a big scale, like the 9/11 scare here, where people hundreds of them were murdered for in the name of religion, and also comes into George Tiller, Wichita, where one person was murdered in the name of religion. That religion should be a matter of love, not a matter of hate, but love and hate are really pretty closely related emotions, if you'll just admit it. And too many people use religion for hate, and that's what bothers me so much about organized religion.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Miller.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you, and I look forward to reading some of this on the web or in print or whatever it comes out on the final studies, because I'm really interested in the religions of Kansas. I've visited a lot of small places and try to see what goes on, and I've got friends in a lot of different places in Kansas, and not only in congregational churches, but in other churches, because I've had quite an interest in that. And I appreciate what you're doing.
Oh, no problem.
Your time.
Thank you.